6 more cents at the pump. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Hope you had a nice Easter weekend. Just ahead, as Washington is proposing a multi-trillion dollar infrastructure bill, the city of Jacksonville is looking to raise the cost of gas to pay for local infrastructure improvements. We'll discuss that and more with mayoral candidate Matt Carlucci in a moment. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, why a new report says the state's so-called anti-riot bill could cost Florida millions in lost revenue. First, though, the latest numbers on the pandemic. Coronavirus cases increased overnight by nearly 5,000. However, hospitalizations ticked down by a couple of dozen or so. Deaths rose again overnight. The toll from the virus now stands at 33,674. But vaccinations are going upward, too. Nearly 6.3 million Florida residents have gotten at least one dose of a vaccine. All Florida residents 18 and older are now eligible to get the vaccine starting today, all adults. So if you haven't gotten vaccinated yet, go today. And here's more news. 16 and 17-year-olds in Florida are now able to get the Pfizer vaccination, only the Pfizer vaccination, at participating locations. However, they have to be accompanied by a parent or guardian who will have to sign a consent form. And of course, here in Duval County, Jacksonville is starting off the month of April with no more mask mandate. Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry decided to let it expire at the end of March. At the same time, as I mentioned, the city is looking at a 6-cent increase to Jacksonville's gas tax. If the city council approves, it would be used to fund up to $930 million in transportation improvements throughout the city. This move comes just as President Biden is pushing a massive infrastructure bill nationwide. There's a lot to talk about this Monday. Jacksonville council member and mayoral candidate Matt Carlucci joins us once again with thoughts on all of these items and more. Matt Carlucci, good to have you back on the show. Good morning.
Good morning. It's always good to be on your show. Thank you for inviting me.
And what are your questions for Matt Carlucci? 549-2937. Already getting your calls. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. Lots to talk about in the news, Matt, with vaccinations and masks and such, and I want to get your reaction to that 60 Minutes report last night on Governor DeSantis. But first, let's get into this big local story. The JTA board voted last week supporting a 6-cent increase to the city's gas tax. Mm-hmm. It will likely pass city council, would fund hundreds of millions in improvements like roadways and sidewalk improvements, drainage systems, beefing up the skyway. Where do you stand on the gas tax?
Well, I generally support the gas tax. I think the biggest role that I have to do myself is to make sure that we get the word out on what the details are of the plan and why it's important. But in the JTA, they're going to have to sell to the community the new concept, extending the people mover. And, you know, on that one, I think we all need to give it an open mind. I've done a lot of research and homework on the people mover. And, you know, that's been an easy punching bag over the years. I get that. But this is different. And I think it looks to the future of our community. I generally support it, and I want to support it. We've got to invest in our community. It doesn't come at a great time because gas prices are going up. I did something a little bit interesting yesterday. I started comparing gas prices in Jacksonville to the gas prices in Clay County, and they have a 12-cent gas tax. We have a 6-cent gas tax. And the prices were actually, Clay County's prices were less than Duval County's. So I don't know, you know, if that means we won't see an increase or not. I'm just kind of throwing that out there. I'm not what pushed. I've never have known exactly what pushes gas prices up and down. Mm. Obviously, demand and supply and so forth. But gas prices have a way of coming up, going down, coming up, and going down. And so there's never really a great time to pass a tax, except when you want to invest in the future of our community. So for that reason, we still have a lot of due diligence to do on this, but in general, I support it.
Okay. What about the opposing view? Here's an email from a comment on Facebook from a listener. Dan writes, with Washington proposing a multi-trillion dollar infrastructure bill, shouldn't we wait and see what we can get from that pool of money before imposing another local gas tax? What do you think?
Well, I think if we wait around for Congress, we may be waiting for a long time. Mm-hmm. My opinion is that, and this is why I like local government, is local rule, and we can decide our own fate. And he makes a good point, though. If we were to receive additional dollars for infrastructure, that would just complement what the 6-cent gas tax will do, what the half penny is doing for schools, how much money it's going to take to bring our infrastructure back up. But more so, you know, we need to be looking to the future, what Jacksonville's going to look like in 2030, 2040, 2050. You know, it's going to take some dollars of investment, and I think we need to start out. I think this is the right time to do it. And the gas tax, the other thing about the gas tax that I like is it allows Jacksonville to start addressing failing septic tanks throughout the community, and that is a real threat to our public mm-hmm. health and welfare, not only of our children who are playing in the front yard where there may be a septic tank that's failing, but also to our waterways, which eventually lead to the St. Johns River. So this does a lot of things.
You are the first official declared candidate for Jacksonville mayor. The race is a couple of years out. The current mayor, Lenny Curry, his downtown working group, as they're called, last week they recommended the city of Jacks spend more than $100 million to revitalize downtown, boost the riverfront, both the South and North Bank, the parks in particular, add entertainment, and help the homeless, a whole wish list. Does the city need to spend this money, and how would you handle public expenditures like this if you were elected mayor?
Well, first thing, I think everything they outlined is what's been talked about for years and years and years, but there's never been really any action taken. So I applaud them for the work they did. I think they left out one really important ingredient, and that is public involvement. There's a lot of groups in Jacksonville. There's a lot of individuals, people, who want to be involved in a community discussion about what goes downtown and how they see our waterfront looking. And so that's what I call bottom up. So the way that I would handle it would be totally different from the way it's been handled over the years. I think the people need to be involved. You need a good urban planner who can listen to what people have to say through charrettes. And I know that's a French word, but if we can get past that, that's a really great way to hear what people want for Jacksonville, what they want for our future. And there's so many young people that want to have a say-so in all of this. And so I applaud the group for what they did, but I think they overlooked, to me, in my opinion, the biggest thing, and that is, you know, let's make sure the community has a large involvement role in how we move forward with downtown, how we handle the homeless. And because then, when you engage the public and they buy in, if you need extra dollars to fund this type of development, people will most usually chip in. But if they're not a part of it, and it just comes from the top to the bottom, you know, and vote for this or that, you know, and there's no real give and take with our people, then I think that's a mistake.
Now, as we talk about all of these action items or issues for the city, at the same time, vaccinations are continuing around town at multiple locations, just as current Mayor Lenny Curry decided to let the county mask mandate expire. This is the first week where we won't see it in effect anymore in Duval. What do you think about that decision?
You know, I can't criticize the decision. To me, I think that it probably was about time. And I think
even with these variants still active in the state that are more...
I'm sorry, what was that?
Even with the COVID variants that are seen as really contagious and even more deadly, still active in Florida?
I hear what you're saying. But this is what I've noticed, and this is what I believe will continue to happen. I think people have been conditioned to wear the mask for the most part. My wife and I, we've got one shot. My wife's going to go get her second shot today. I go one day next week. Mm. But we'll probably continue to wear our mask, and I know a lot of other people feel the same way. I think we see how it goes. But,
okay. All right.
But sometimes people, when they're asked to volunteer to do something and not mandated, sometimes they'll step up even better. So I think overall the mayor's done a good job with the COVID virus, and I think you know that the mayor and I have our fair share of disagreements. But when you think somebody's done a pretty good job with it, I believe in saying so.
Where do you see your biggest area of disagreement with the current administration? And if you were elected, what would be the biggest difference the voters out there would see?
The status quo will come to an end. And again, I'm going to go back to a government that gets a lot of its ideas and builds consensus with the people. So the people become the ownership of whatever gas tax, downtown development. When they become the owner of that, then I believe it helps our community to move together. When you don't involve the people, and I hear this often, so this is why I think it's important. People don't feel engaged. They don't feel they have an ownership in it. They didn't even have a say in it. It's like you vote for this or nothing. That's not my way, is to work with the people. I have to be a leader and provide that leadership. But leadership is no good if you don't have anybody following behind you as the leader. And the other thing that involving the public does to a great degree is when the next mayor comes along, that mayor, he or she, looks at what the previous mayor did. But it wasn't really the mayor. It was the community. And that impels, I think, whoever the next mayor to be is, to continue moving along in that same direction so we have more continuity.
Let's go to some calls now for Matt Carlucci. Excuse me, I've got a bit of a sore throat this morning.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I'm no COVID, though. I have received my vaccine, too. So 549-2937, Rusty on the west side. Hi, Rusty. Good morning.
Good morning, Matt. You might be too virtuous, brave, and upstanding for this game of mayoral politics. But regardless of what the actual numbers are, here on the west side, it seems like broad sections of the west side, whatever markers you want to use, educational attainment, per capita income, the wealth-poverty gap, housing stability, dysfunction, These things are moving in the wrong direction for pretty large areas of the west side in particular. And it seems like about 65% of the population doesn't care. And they might even celebrate the growth of the gap. Is this a stark new political reality? Take it off.
Well, it's the way that... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Let me just put it like this. When I become mayor, and I don't say that overconfidently, but when you're running for mayor, you got to be bold enough to envision yourself as mayor. So when I become mayor, one thing that I think is critically important, and I don't want to spill my plan out because we're still fleshing it out some, but I believe this with all my heart, that our city needs to get to know each other better from one side of town to another. That way, somebody on the south side understands what somebody on the west side what their needs are. And all around the city, we become to know who Jacksonville is, and it's made up of different sides of towns with different traditions, cultures, and needs. And so it all kind of centers around my theme of Jacksonville moves better when we move together. We can't move together that well if we don't know the problems that other parts of town have. And I think that is a big problem. A lot of folks don't understand what the needs of the west side are or the north side. And to be honest with you, a lot of people are like that because they're busy with their own world and taking their kids to school, paying their taxes, you know, trying to run their business. But when Jacksonville becomes to know each other better and we begin to love each other more, we're going to be a better city. And that I will tell you, if there was one goal I had, my vision could be summed up in removing this tag we have of a tale of two cities to how we became the tale of one city. And to do that, and our family has
to get together. You're saying understanding has to be part of it, but we can understand the problems of the west side or the north side, but it doesn't change the problems. It requires action.
Absolutely requires action.
So what you're proposing, and you've said this on the program before, is you believe the city will have to find new revenue sources in the next several years. And that the city for many years has underinvested in itself.
We have. And the first thing that when I take office, I've got to look and see what money I can find that we have before I, you know, attempt to raise any additional new revenue, and see what perhaps our bonding capacity might be for projects within the budget that we have. So, you know, you don't want to go in and just be a taxer. That turns people off. They want to make sure you're spending the current money you have as wisely as you can be. But there will be times, just like with this gas tax, when the need is so big that we have to raise the revenue, and we're doing that with the 6-cent gas tax.
All right, and not to cut you off. Sorry, just so many callers. If I may, let's get some callers on.
Okay, I'll try to be quicker.
Mark on the west side, go ahead, Mark.
Mr. Carlucci, two quick things. I wonder if you would address how we're trying to repair all these septic tank problems with money apparently we don't have, yet we continue to be building whole entire neighborhoods on septic tanks. It seems like not very smart. And also, I've got to hand it to the mayor and his marketing team for saying this is an infrastructure tax, when in reality the majority of it is going to this harebrained, let's beat a dead horse Skyway Express thing. You know, just 2 years ago, the then COO of the JTA said we were going to let this Skyway Express kind of die. It wasn't proving itself. It never had. And I haven't seen anything, and I've been paying attention, that this future iteration of the Skyway Express is any better or will be an improvement. I mean, why in the world?
I got you, Mark. Not to cut you off. We've just got a lot of folks waiting. Are we spending good money after bad on the Skyway? Matt Carlucci.
I cannot imagine spending 90-some-odd million dollars to tear it down and to also give ourselves a bad reputation with the Federal Transportation Authority. What I want to say about the people mover is I would just ask our people and myself, and I have to do this myself because I never supported it, but myself, is to keep an open mind. And when you keep an open mind, that's a good place to be. We need to look ahead to 2030, 2040, 2050, and not in the rearview mirror of what happened in the 1980s. Jacksonville's a different place. More and more people are living downtown, the downtown adjacent neighborhoods like Brooklyn, Springfield, San Marco, Riverside are filling up with upwardly mobile young folks who want to get to restaurants, shopping, and entertainment in the downtown and close by neighborhoods without having to drive. This new system is going to be so much more nimble. is going to come down to the ground. It's not going to always be elevated. It's going to have more stops. I think it's really worth looking at with an open mind, which means we just got to quit looking in that rearview mirror of its problems in the past, because this is going to be a completely different system.
Okay. Okay. Comments on social media. Laura writes, for years, all we've heard is downtown development. It's a boondoggle because developers are allowed to build willy-nilly on the south side. Just drive down JTB and you see it. I hope if you are mayor, you will evaluate how development is structured countywide, she says. And lots of calls. Russell in Mandarin. Hello, Russell.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call.
If you could get off speaker, please, Russell.
I am off speaker.
Could you get off it?
I am off speaker.
Okay, great. You just sound really hollow. Go ahead.
Okay. I agree with Mr. Carlucci. In local government, people should have more say in what's going on. Government should be more transparent in how they spend our tax dollars. A good example of that would be JEA or the deal that Mr. Khan was trying to involve the city in developing his idea of what downtown should be. All good ideas. People should be involved. We need to know what's going on with our government and how they're spending our money. Last week, though, I saw a statistic that was interesting. There are three states, Florida, California, and Texas. And these three states account for 20% of the new coronavirus cases in the world. In the world. What part of this country? Well, I didn't see that statistic, but 20% in the world. And now Mayor Curry wants to do away with masks when there are European countries who are going into total lockdowns to try and shut this down. We are not treating this seriously, and all we hear is public rhetoric, and it's more from Mr. Carlucci.
Okay,
what
Russell,
do you think about
thank
that?
You for that. And if I could, Matt Carlucci, if you could respond to his comment, and I'd also like you to respond quickly to the 60 Minutes report last night on how Governor Ron DeSantis has handled vaccinations in Florida. But let's begin with the mask mandate. The Times Union has called, by the way, for Mayor Curry to reinstate it. Your thoughts?
I'm not for reinstating it right now. I believe our people will continue to wear masks and use a common sense approach. If it doesn't work, then you know what? You got to change your mind. You know, those who don't change their mind never change anything. I think Winston Churchill said that. I think he's done a good job with this. And now, I didn't watch 60 Minutes last night. I normally do, so I'm not real sure what the governor is what that show is about. I want to go back to one
thing.
Well,
it had to do with okay. allegations that wealthy Floridians jumped the line to get their vaccines, that people were flying in from all over the country to get vaccines ahead of residents, and also it questioned the decision to give Publix an exclusive vaccine contract shortly after they donated to the governor and his campaign. So that was the substance of it.
Okay. Well, if all of that is true, as wrong as it can be. We shouldn't have people coming in from out of town skipping in front of our people. And we shouldn't be giving exclusive rights to people who give to our campaigns. That's what's got us in the problem today. And just one thing I want to say, if I can, is promoting my campaign for mayor a bit. But you know what? My contributors, they're all regular, traditional contributors for the very most part. And so I won't go in owing anybody anything except for good government. That's it. And I am so tired of hearing of different companies, same old companies, same old crowd, getting the same old business from government, whether it be local, state, or federal. I'm over that. There's a lot of people that do work in Jacksonville, and they ought to be given a fair shot at it. And we need to be taking care of our people. So if all that's happening, I didn't see the show, but if that is correct, then I would disagree with all of the above.
Linda on the South Side. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Yes, I wonder what Mr. Carlucci thinks of the idea of reinstating JCCI. He's mentioned bringing the people into the decisions, and there really wasn't a better way to do that in Jacksonville. I know there's a movement, and would he support it and possibly have funding from the city, because otherwise you don't get an impartial group.
Thanks for that. Yeah, the local think tank, JCCI, after a five-year hiatus, is coming back to life. How do you see that improving the civic dialogue in Jacksonville?
Well, it works perfectly, and I saw that in the paper, and I was thrilled about it, because the JCCI has people that work their hearts out to make those reports, and then so many times they're not listened to, they're not thought of, they're not taken off the shelf and executed. So the JCCI works right into my playbook of listening to the people, because they reach out to people. They're a think tank of citizens from all stratas of Jacksonville. And so I welcome their backing. I would be very friendly towards funding them, as long as they're getting funding from other places as well. I think they're an invaluable tool. I've been involved with the JCCI in the past, and I think they'd be I'm thrilled they're going to be back in Jacksonville.
Noel on the South Side, what's your question for Matt Carlucci? Hi, Noel, you're on the air.
Hi.
Go
ahead. Good morning. I had a little bit of a question regarding to you talking about downtown and how people are using transit now, and the taxes in general. I used to live in Washington, and in Whidbey Island, they actually got rid of, for that whole Tri-City area up into Mount Vernon, they didn't have any monetary exchange for riding the buses. And I know that transit can be a lot of a problem for many people in Jacksonville. And it actually costs less for the county for them to have no money because there's less accounting for it, et cetera. In Seattle, they also had a free line.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I don't know if that's a possible option. And there's some taxes like reallocated to take care of that need. I know that COVID has been really frustrating and hard for everybody, especially with public transit and Ubers has become more popular with all the pricing and everything. I also wanted to mention that there was a fantastic TED Talk that I had the pleasure and the opportunity to see back in 2017. I was born and raised in the Virgin Islands, and it was speaking directly about diversity.
Okay. Lots of comments there. Thank you.
I love what she just said, and I want to mention one thing, if I can, Melissa. I have been working with the administration on a citizens oversight committee. There'll be 12 citizens. It'll be built into the bill unless they change their minds. They will be expected to be from all sides of town and a diverse group of people that looks like Jacksonville. And so I'm very encouraged on that. And also, now that'll be in the bill. What I can't put in the bill, but what I've encouraged and they've been very open to, is having at least 5 large town meetings in the geographical areas of the at-large council members, where you go and you can look at different stations that might have to do with your part of town, another part of town, the people mover, and so on and so forth. And you go for an hour and you talk to professionals, engineers, and the JTA about that. And then it transitions to a regular town meeting where people get to have the chance to ask questions and the mayor, the council members, and the JTA and the JEA have a chance to respond and sell something that they think is good for the community.
Mm. Okay. Here's a comment for you from Facebook. Jim asks, if better connecting the city and finding new revenue are Matt Carlucci's priorities, would he support the plan for JEA offering Wi-Fi through the electric grid? Using the utility to connect the entire county with Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi. That is something that's been proposed and that activists are pressing JEA to consider.
Okay. Well, I certainly would consider it. I'd want to talk to JEA first about that. But I think there's a great great need the Wi-Fi and also fiber optics. JEA has got a great opportunity to extend our fiber optics more into the downtown area, which would attract more businesses down there. And then also, I want to say one other thing, going back to the lady on the downtown development. I think that a lot of people don't know there's a lot of things happening downtown, but they're singles and they're doubles, like in a baseball game. And you win baseball games with singles and doubles and then an occasional home run. I think too often you know, we look for the big home run, and then we strike out, and then we look for another big home run, and we strike out. But right now, there's about 13 buildings downtown that will be historically restored, or they're just old buildings that will be adopted for new uses, and you're going to have, and they're going to be in a cluster type area, compact, and there'll be uses that are complementary of each other.
Not to cut you off, but when it comes to downtown and infrastructure improvements and spending, we are getting lots of tweets for you about your support of the gas tax and comparisons to what the smartness of that compared to investing in the proposed Emerald Trail. That's the green belt that's supposed to go all around the city when it's completed. Several tweets asking why there isn't more money set aside for the Emerald Trail expansion. And that's being done by Groundwork Jacksonville. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I love the Emerald Trail. I've invested in it privately. My family has. And so that's a good point, and that's something that can be discussed as we take this out onto with town meetings on the with the public. But I don't, that's such a great project. But also, this what the half penny is being used for is going for such great projects, and is going to open up opportunities to replace the failing septic tanks. Although new septic tanks may be put in, if they're working, they're okay. But it's ones that are failing. There's 22,000 that are failing. So we've got to get a start on that. That would also help the Emerald Trail, by the way. But, when I become mayor, the Emerald Trail is going to be that, and a lot of other projects is going to be right at the top of my list. And I'm going to have a discussion about it as a public.
All right. And I want to thank you, Matt Carlucci, city council member at large and mayoral candidate, for joining us. We appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the offer, and thank you very much. And hope your listeners have a wonderful week.
Now, of course, the mayor's race is still a couple of years out. As soon as more candidates declare and throw their hat in the ring officially, we will invite them to appear on this program as well. Much more still ahead. Later, a conversation with CNN anchor Brooke Baldwin on her new book, Huddle. And up next, a closer look at the state's proposed anti-rioting bill. We'll be right back. Well, a new report out today says the so-called anti-riot bill moving through the Florida legislature would cost the state in the tens of millions of dollars. Dr. Rick Harper is an economist and director of the University of West Florida Haas Center for Business Research and Economic Development. He's the report's author and joins us now. Dr. Harper, good morning.
Good morning to you. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Now, this bill in the legislature is the governor's top priority. It's actually labeled HB1. And critics have called it an attempt to criminalize peaceful protests. However, the governor and lawmakers say it would simply crack down on violent protests. You looked at this through an economic lens. What did you find?
Well, I did. Being an economist, I like to look at public policy in terms of its fiscal impact. That is, does it increase available tax revenue to fund other projects, or does it decrease that tax revenue? And what does it do to Floridians' incomes? And HB 1, Senate Bill 484, doesn't do a good job on either count. If we increase the criminality in the jail sentence for things that are already prohibited under Florida law, such as property damage or violence, then what that means is increased burden on our prisons. I estimated that impact using plausible data. Our state's revenue estimating process has looked at some of these impacts and said that the effect would be increased expenditures. And prison beds are expensive. If we're looking at spending $24,000 a year per prisoner, which is cheap relative to other states, Florida's done a good job of economizing, it's going to cost citizens more. And this runs the risk of reversing the very beneficial decline that we've seen in prison expenditures over the last dozen years. We're actually down about $1.5 billion in inflation-adjusted terms in what we spend in our tax revenue on maintaining Department of Corrections. So we're at risk of reversing that.
Now, it's already against the law to riot, to assault people, to destroy property. This law would increase penalties that already exist. And it would also, critics say, give the state power to charge peaceful protesters who are at a protest that becomes violent. If they're even present at the protest, it could potentially open the door for them to be charged with felonies as well. So is what you're saying is that we might see more people caught up in the criminal justice system because of the enhanced penalties of this bill?
Absolutely. And it's not just the cost to taxpayers to fund those additional beds in the prison system, but also if you look at the scholarly literature over the past number of years, it's clear that additional jail time very much decreases people's employment opportunities and their connection to the labor market. So that's another source of damages, is that the protesters who could be caught up in a sweep under this new bill are more likely than existing felony prisoners, more likely to be employed, protesters are, and be better educated, have higher incomes. And so the loss of income, earning potential, will persist over time because, as we know from initiatives like Ban the Box, should people have to check that they have a felony conviction on their records when they apply, we know that employers' perception of people who have a felony conviction is that they shouldn't employ them, that they're likely to be a risk. And that means that all those political protesters who might be caught up would have less earning potential over time, and that's an effect that can last decades. So both on the expenditure side for the state for more prison beds and on the personal income side for people who would otherwise be out there earning income, supporting their families, paying taxes, these are the places that, from the economic perspective, the bill hurts Floridians.
Now, you're an economist, not a criminal justice expert, but where do you stand on the critics of this bill saying that it would criminalize free speech and that it would be an unconstitutional infringement on the First Amendment?
Well, again, as an economist and not a political scientist, my interest is in looking at what the bill means economically for Floridians. But it seems clear that by increasing the scope and the criminality of offenses, things that you want to decrease, you put incentives in place to make them more costly. And this clearly puts incentives in place to make any form of protest more costly for the Floridians who will do it. Also, the bill contains a provision saying that municipal governments will lose their sovereign immunity. That's the provision in the law that says that a citizen can only sue his or her government entity, whether it's state or local in the state of Florida, for a maximum of $200,000. Well, this bill takes away that immunity for local governments so that if someone is injured or if property is destroyed during a riot, as defined by the new bill, then the owner can sue local government for unlimited damages. And what happens when you make someone able to sue for unlimited damages is there's inevitably going to be more lawsuits against local government, because every time there is something that's defined as illegal under the new statute, then people will recruit the plaintiff's attorney, or the plaintiff's lawyers will recruit those people, and they'll go and sue local governments. Think what that's going to do for the risk insurance premiums that local governments have to pay. It's going to be more expensive, and it can easily affect the bond ratings of local governments if there is this new potential unlimited liability for an act that might occur on at a city park or within the jurisdiction of the city. What the plaintiff will have to prove is that the city or the county didn't do enough to prevent this so-called riot. So that's an additional source of financial risk for local governments. I anticipate it would have a chilling effect on the issuance of permits to hold a protest or a parade or a spring break gathering, for that matter. Those things could all lead to large liability for local governments.
Do any other states have a statute like this? Would Florida be an outlier if this passes?
Well, it's a relatively strict provision, and it's not clear whether it would even be constitutional to charge people with rioting who were not in any way involved in violence or property damage. So I anticipate that this would be among the strictest of national statutes, but it's to protect against things that are already illegal under Florida statute. And so in that sense, it's kind of a solution in search of a problem, and it's got very negative fiscal impacts as well. So, yes, it would change Florida's status in terms of whether people are allowed to do political protest or not relative to other states.
Well, thank you for joining us. He's Dr. Rick Harper, economist and longtime director of the University of West Florida Haas Center for Business Research and Economic Development. And this report is out today. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Still to come, CNN's Brooke Baldwin on the power of a women's huddle inside the pages of her new book. We'll be right back.
Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at vickerslanding.com. Congaree & Penn Landscape Trees, Jacksonville's family-owned large tree installation, relocation, and comprehensive landscape installer. More info and appointments available at congareetrees.com or 527-1945.
In the high desert of Southern California, like way out there, the federal government used to give land away for free. Now, though...
every property I looked at sold within 2 days, above asking price, so I knew something was going on here.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. What is going on out there anyway? We'll tell you, and we'll have the numbers from Wall Street and the rest of the day's business news, of course, next time on Marketplace.
Tomorrow night at 6 here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Brandi Carlile. She won 3 Grammys in 2019, including Best Americana Album. Her new memoir opens with her as a very sick child, in a coma and near death. The book ends with Carlile, her wife and their 2 children, living in a compound with their extended family in the state of Washington. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
See you, dear old friend. Go down to the water.
Meet Maria from Illinois.
I have turned all of my efforts to using a credit union to the fullest, and I'm quite happy with that move.
Millions of Americans don't have a bank account. For some, it's a choice. But for many, that choice is made for them. And at what cost? America's unbanked and underbanked. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. CNN anchor Brooke Baldwin is out this week with a new book on the power of women in groups and how you can leverage this dynamic for yourself. It's called Huddle. I spoke with her. Take a listen.
Hi, Brooke. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
And I love the title of your book, Huddle, because you've kind of taken a sports metaphor, which we tend to think of as a bunch of guys in football pads, and now you're giving that a feminine cast. So what inspired you to talk about this, the way women huddle and how we help each other personally and professionally?
Yeah, and Melissa, I'm so glad you picked up on the masculine-laced word huddle. I picked it on purpose. I wanted to take that word and flip it on its head and feminize it, and I want us as women to own it, right? It's a noun, it's a verb, it's an action I want to inspire women to take. And so why did I write this? So I believe, just outside of, you know, power and representation, that we as women are each other's best resource. And for me, you know, the biggest compliment I can ever get is for somebody to call me a woman's woman. You know, I've played sports, I danced, I did gymnastics as a kid. I was always surrounded by girls. I had so many girl huddles. And then I, you know, ultimately fell in love with journalism. And so I picked a profession where I have really been surrounded by men. You know, here at CNN, for the most part, my bosses are men. The, you know, biggest stars, highest paid at most TV networks are men. You know, for a decade, my executive producer was a man. The person who oversees CNN Dayside is a man. I sit in the chair and cover the nation's most powerful men. Like, you sense a theme. And so, you know, there I was covering the presidential election of 2016. And then I was in the Trump covering the Trump inauguration. And then the very next day, like, wham, I'm in the middle of this women's march. And I'm standing there with my reporter hat on, and I'm looking at the thousands of women, and I see, just to see women showing up for one another like that in this one massive 500,000 women huddle was something that stopped me in my tracks. And I had noticed, you know, covering the election, that so many women were showing up in a way I had never noticed in my 20-year career. But I was standing there covering this women's march, and I was thinking, like, gosh, if I wasn't reporting on this, would I have attended this march? Who would I have attended it with? Did I have a huddle? And the answer is I didn't. And so it was a real aha moment for me. And it was really the beginning, the unofficial beginning of my journey to write this book and also find my own huddle and bring intentionality to it. And I just want to urge women reading the book to do the same.
I think a lot of women do this without intentionality. It just sort of comes naturally to them. So what are some ways, because you talk to women throughout modern history, some really well-known, some just doing this in their regular lives, to try to help women leverage this power and understand how this can work for them. So how are you doing this in your life, and how do you think more women can do this as well?
Yeah, first let me just say to your original point, I think this is different from networking or having just a friendship. This, it has real intentionality to it. This isn't just happenstance or you happen to have drinks with some women or networking. This is intentional, and there is a clear mission, which is to build a bigger table for women. And, you know, for me in my career, I made the choice to put career first coming out of journalism school, where all of my, you know, girlfriends from college were moving to the big cities and living their best Sex and the City lives and not entirely sure maybe what they wanted to do, but they knew who they wanted to be with. And I jumped into the deep end of journalism and, you know, was alone for, I mean, certainly I had some friends in various parts around the country, but, you know, I was really like sacrificing a lot and working all the crazy hours and all the holidays, you know, because I wanted to be a reporter. And I was really lonely in all of my 20s, really, and even into my early 30s, because I didn't have a huddle. And so as I've grown older, and especially since writing this book the last 2 years, I've activated several huddles in my life. And I feel like the strength of my huddle is sometimes like in direct correlation with the success I've been having. And so I've certainly had and activated a CNN huddle where, you know, if you were to look at some of our text chains or in the before times when we were in person, you know, we would talk salary. We would talk about opportunities. We would text one another if somebody was getting a bit talked over by a man.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
I mean, it happens all the
time.
Yes,
it does.
Like, I'll text a girlfriend. It'll be like a huge day of coverage, and I don't want to out anyone, and I don't want to say what channel, but, you know, and I'll text somebody, and I'll say, man, like, you did a really great job of supporting all of his points, but he talked all over you. And it's just a matter, you know, we're there for one another, and it just right. makes it less lonely. And still, what is a man's world? I really feel like the huddle is the silver lining.
In the meantime, pick up Brooke's new book. It's out today. It's called Huddle, How Women Unlock Their Collective Power by CNN anchor and now author Brooke Baldwin. Brooke, thanks.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with the woman I huddle with every day, producer Heather Schatz, and director Josh Torres, part of our posse, along with news director Jessica Palumbo and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Keep those emails coming. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And you can catch our podcast up later today, wherever you like to listen. You can also listen to this show and a lot of other content through the WJCT app. Download it today. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great first Monday of April.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.